have a lot to cover. You see, I was planning to give a lecture yesterday afternoon. I trust in the Spirit, and that the Spirit will use me in whatever way to say, hopefully, whatever I can that will continue to be helpful to you. So I don't feel any pressure after I've said that on myself. Where I want to start is using two quotes. One from, there's a fellow by the name of, his last name is Sin Gay. He's written a book called The Fifth Discipline. It's in the business world. The subtitle is Creating Learning Environments. I have found this book extremely helpful. There's a whole chapter, several chapters on personal vision and then common vision and how to create personal vision and common vision. There's a section where he talks about cynicism. And this is just a quote. Scratch the surface of most cynics and you find a frustrated idealist, someone who made the mistake of converting his ideals into expectations. Many cynical people once held high ideals about people. Then they found themselves disappointed, hurt, and eventually embittered because people fell short of their ideals. Burnout comes from causes other than simply working too hard. There are teachers, social workers, and clergy who work incredibly hard until they are 80 years old and never suffer burnout because they have an accurate view of human nature. They don't over-romanticize people, so they don't feel the great psychological stress when people let them down. Now, I found that very, very helpful because in my own mind, I'm not a cognitive psychologist, but those cognitive psychologists who are therapists, one of the truths they try to point out to people is what are your expectations and how are you constructing the world that ends up setting you up for expectations and disappointments. And the point about cynicism is that at least my communication with an awful lot of bishops and major superiors and rank and file clergy and religious, the word cynicism comes up an awful lot. A lot of people are suffering from a more cynical attitude. Why? I mean, I think in light of what Bishop World talked about, the Vatican II, high expectations, everybody's excited, and we're gonna meet, the doors are open, we're gonna really move forward. And I was, a very young man when that was happening. I just started my college career at Holy Cross College in Worcester in 64, and it was just a very exciting time. And as history indicates, and human nature, I mean, people get excited, all kinds of energy is harnessed, and then we have to kind of hit the pavement of reality, you see? And as we start hitting the pavement of reality and doing the practical implications, things start getting sticky. Now, it's almost someone never told anybody or never told a lot of people that things were going to get sticky. But if we listen to history, you know, over and over again, that's part of life. Stickiness, junk, suffering. I mean, no one said that it was going to be a wonderful time. Even though there were a lot of indications that, you know, people were very filled with hope. So the point is that I think a lot of people, not just because of the Vatican II Council, but just expectations, and then psychology came in, and I'm a psychologist, and I love being a psychologist, but I think, you know, as you know and as well as I do, there's been a number of articles written on how psychology has been put up, has replaced clergy, and people turn to psychologists or mental health field workers as, tell me who I'm supposed to be. And a lot of these people and a lot of these theories aren't grounded in a Christian tradition, you see? And so what happens philosophically is that it's not like what comes down the pike, but what emerges in the culture. I mean, Pat gave a nice, I think it was Pat, who talked about happiness as a political issue, see? I mean, who said in the story of human nature, in the story of the human person, that happiness was going to be it? But you keep on reading all these popular books that indicate that, you know, if you just do this and just do this, you know, you will be happy. I mean, I don't believe in happiness. I believe in peace. I feel that if I do my own homework personally, and I continue to follow the tradition of the classical spiritual masters and the Gospels, and continue to dialogue on my own life and what the people in my ordinary life teach me about myself, I think I can grow into peace. That's the best shot that I can make, you see. I don't anticipate that I'm going to be happy. I'm going to be peaceful. Hopefully, I can make peace with the suffering and not lose sleep over how much evil there is in the world. Okay? So, but my point is that ideals, as wonderful as they are, can get us into a lot of trouble if we're not grounded in reality. And so the reality, that the key point here for me here is an accurate view of human nature. And I think that unfortunately, this is just my piece here, that when a lot of clergy and religious were training, there's a reason in the church's tradition and formation that you're invited to take up philosophy. You see, hopefully as a philosopher who learns how to philosophize, you see, can think and reflect and meditate about the human condition. Unfortunately, a lot of the philosophers that were teaching young seminarians ended up getting into a more rational approach, sometimes a memorization approach, and really didn't help people to philosophize about the existential situation. Do you see what I mean? So that as the culture moves forward, you have a group of men who need to be able to understand the human condition, the human nature, as it's being colored by the culture and the pulsation of the culture. And so the like even the way that Bishop Worrell is talking about preaching and teaching through homilies, you know, to be able to be guided in your homilies by an accurate view of human nature, helping people to make sense in a meaningful way of their everyday lived experience through an accurate view of human nature. So the point that he's making here is that cynicism is coming from people who do not have an accurate view of human nature, an accurate view of reality. And I bump into that over and over again, not just in terms of my clients, but a lot of people just swept up and do not, another word for this whole business is that they don't have their feet on the ground. They have their head in the air. They're like one of the Dr. Seuss characters. You know, he has this elongated neck, and he's just sort of like way up there in the clouds. Okay, second point. In the book by Sam Keen, Fire in the Belly, he comes back and helps us, again, somewhat on the same point. He says, but finally, stress cannot be dealt with by psychological tricks, because for the most part, it is a philosophical rather than a physiological problem, a matter of the wrong world view. Perhaps the most common variety of stress can be called rust out rather than burnout. It is a product not of an excess of fire, but a deficiency of passion, you see? And then he goes on and he says, burnout is nature's way of telling you You've been going through the motions, but your soul has departed. You're a zombie, a member of the walking dead, a sleepwalker. Okay. Now again, what I like about this, about the King's statement, is he's saying that burnout or stress is a philosophical rather than a physiological problem, a worldview problem. Now, yesterday in my talks is what I was trying to develop, that faith is a worldview issue, you see, a worldview, as I tried to explicate, in which your worldview is connected with the ultimate horizon, huh? And in that, if I find in my own life, the more I can remember the presence of God, John Shea, sacramental consciousness, the bigger worldview, the more, as soon as I recognize that bigger worldview, I find myself being able to surrender. Because I put things in perspective then. But if I lose myself in the narrowness of tunnel vision, you know, the horse that has the thing around his eyes, this tunnel vision, that's all I see is the moment. And I end up losing myself. So I find that that my worldview, if it's not grounded in reality, grounded in an accurate understanding of human nature, which, by the way, I find, even if I wasn't a Christian, the Christian anthropology, to me, as a philosopher and a psychologist, has an awful lot to offer in terms of an understanding of human nature. I mean, it includes suffering and many things that are just so right on. Now, you may say, well, I mean, but my understanding of Christian anthropology, blah, blah, blah. Well, I think what's happened historically over the years is there's the Christian anthropology has been taken up by citizens, priests, teachers, whatever, philosophers, who have colored the Christian anthropology or seen the Christian anthropology or taken up the Christian anthropology from a cultural dimension, you see? So what happens is, all of a sudden, where the Christian anthropology is grounded in the body, we have the body is evil, you see? And then you say, well, what is an accurate worldview of Christian anthropology? I mean, it's grounded in the body, my interpretation, you see? And then we can get into an argument about it. But nonetheless, my point here is that I like the phrase rust out, and that the phrase the soul under burnout, the soul has departed. You become a zombie, a member of the walking dead, a sleepwalker. Now, what I want to go on and share with you today and bring these points together for you is to talk about sexual injury. Yesterday I talked about, maybe it came across as ideal in the sense of a boy being welcomed by his father and nurtured and nourished by men and the world of men in terms of, like, this would be the wonderful story, the story that would probably be very helpful to most men. And I was saying that typical story didn't happen for most of us, including myself. Even though the accent of my talk yesterday was how men helped me to understand and experience the ultimate meaning, if you will, the larger horizon. But I have been injured just like anybody else, any other man, because these men in my life were also injured. And as Pat talks about generational business, is that we're just starting to take time out research-wise and say, well, how have men been injuring each other along the way? Okay? Now, what I mean by injury is I'm going to use a couple images. If you drive down the highway, any highway, and it happens to be on what I'll call a wind path, you'll notice that these young evergreens are tipped over a little bit. I mean, they grow to an angle because, you know, the wind keeps on hitting them, and it has such a force that subtly it begins to twist the tree. You've seen them on the highway? Yes? No? Okay. All right. So then, if I take you into my garden, it was more the vegetable gardens, but nonetheless, my perennials have a little dash of it here and there. There's all kinds of, you know, insects that end up turning leaves colors, drilling holes in the leaves, eating stems, and all kinds of things that you could say, or the way that I would end up saying, that these things injure the plants. Huh? They're not like the perfect plant. They're injured. You see, they've been diseased in some way. They're not totally wholesome. All right. So what I mean by injury is that there is some kind of subtle twisting, if you will, subtle diminishing of what the plant or the tree or us human beings are called to be in that sense. So sexual injury. I used the example or the imagery yesterday afternoon, singing my song, dancing my dance, playing my instrument. So sexual injury is anything that is preventing me in my story from the time that I'm born to the time I am present that prevents me from singing my song, dancing my dance, and playing my instrument. That's how I'm using the word injury, you see. It's injurious. I'm handicapped. That is to say, I can't be who I really want to be or even could be because there's some things that are holding me back. Father Buckley, is that him? Buckley. He mentioned 8 years ago that I used the word tourniquet, huh? And I'll try to use those kinds of expressions in imagery. See, you can't dance your dance, like I said yesterday afternoon, if your body's in plaster of Paris, you see. You can't dance your dance if you weigh 500 pounds, you see. And you can't dance your dance if you're a zombie, a member of the walking dead, and a sleepwalker, you see. They just don't go together. And you know, and as well as I do, when you walk on the streets or are in your parishes, there are some people, you look at them, and they're filled with aliveness, and you're probably sexually attracted to them, huh? Sexually attracted to men or women. That doesn't mean that you have these amazing sexual fantasies. You just, let me just speak for myself, huh? I'm just drawn to men who are alive, and I'm drawn to women who are alive. And alive in the sense that they are dancing their dance, singing their song, and playing their instrument. And I'm calling that sexual attraction. You see, I'm calling that those people are living out, at the moment at least, a sense of sexuality for me. Okay? So now sexual injury is anything that diminishes that. All right? And there's all kinds of things, and that's what I want to spend the rest of the morning trying to help us to get a feel for what has happened to us, possibly, at least from this perspective, and what things we've had to negotiate as a young boy, as a child, to end up trying to dance our dance, sing our song, and play our instrument. All right. This probably hasn't happened to you, but let me just give you a quick overview. I mean, it begins in the womb. See, and I would say there's cold wombs and warm wombs. There are women who want babies and women who don't want babies. You know, you see on the TV, you know, these crack babies that are born. And you know, they got the shakes and they're diminished, huh, in the sense that womb, that whole system of taking care of the baby, just wasn't ample. Huh? Wasn't nourishing, and you get the diminishment of the baby, the infant being born. Cold wombs emotionally. I mean, your mother may have wanted you, but wasn't a loving. You know, sometimes you see now young women they're taught to kind of rub their belly and to really, you know, recognize that they're really carrying not a thing, but something that they're already being instructed to bond with that which is growing. Now, a lot of women in the previous years did that naturally. But because I think a lot of A lot of people are in their heads, including women. You know, even though they may have a baby growing inside of them, I mean, you know, maybe it's just the image of the yuppie woman, if you will, the high climber, the high charger. She's got a baby, but she's more interested. Look at the mic. She's more interested in her career. You see, and her head is in her career, not in her belly. You see what I mean? So, okay. So there's warm wombs and cold wombs. And you may want to do a reflection of imagining, where did you grow up in a warm womb or a cold womb? Because, you see, if you just imagine going into a cold refrigerator, you know, the walk-in refrigerators, and it's really, really cold, my reaction to that is I end up contracting. You see? So infants who grow in a cold womb, if you will, come out contracted. I'll give you an example. My wife interned in a state hospital. She's a social worker and a psychotherapist. And she interned in a state hospital and she met a mental health worker there. And the mental health worker just had twins, didn't have too much money. We ended up having a crib from our last daughter. We have two children, two daughters, 20 and 18. And this was maybe 10 years ago. So we ended up saying, well, why don't we give this extra crib to this woman? So I went into Worcester and went to her apartment, and I was walking into her apartment, and she said, before you set it up, let me come and see the twins. She's all excited about the twins. And so the twins are in one bed. And this lady went through an awful divorce and is a single parent. And so she looks, and I look down, and I'm shocked. Huh? Because what I see, and she's a talker, and she quickly says, this one reminds me of me, and then her whole voice changes, and this one reminds me of her father. Okay? Now I look at the one who reminds me of her father, and the poor baby is like this, frozen stiff. If remember icicles when you were a kid, you just go like this. Those people who grew up in the north, you go like this and they snap. If I took my hand to that poor little hand, I felt like it was so rigid that her poor little hand or foot or leg would snap. That's how much tension. And what I'm trying to say is that I could sense how much this woman hated this child. Okay? And the child wasn't thriving compared to the twin, the other little baby who reminded of herself, who she bonded and connected, looked as if she had at least 4 more pounds on her, the little baby, and was a lot softer, you see? And so my point is here, is that the first stage of development for me is the first thing that we need to negotiate when we first come out of our mother's womb is, were we welcomed into the world? Were we welcomed into the world? And there are a lot of citizens, and say, so as the baby starts coming out, you know, and someone says it's a boy, it's a girl, I mean, immediately, because it's a girl, someone in the family, you know, and this is maybe stretching the point, but it's not stretching the point, immediately hates the baby. I'm talking about hate. Okay? I'm talking about hate. I'm not talking about dislike or anything. I'm talking about hate. Now, if we had the time and I could get you paired up into two and two, and I'd say, okay, now what I want you to do is look, muster as much hate in your eyes as possible and look at the man next to you with those hateful eyes. And let me go around and interview those men who received the sense of hate from the other person. And immediately, what most of you would start saying is, it scared the hell out of me. Maybe I felt terrorized. I certainly contracted. So what I'm trying to say is that there are babies who are born who, as they come out, for all kinds of reasons, the parent or parents hate the child. And obviously, they're not welcomed into the world. When I gave you the example of in Roots, where the father ends up taking his son and offering the son to the universe and to the world and just blessing and praising, if you will, I mean, that's a welcome. You see, when the priest at baptism ends up taking the baby up in his hands and ends up saying, you know, this baby is for our community in a sense that we are all called to love this child and welcome this child into our community. I mean, that's a welcome. But what is it like now as an adult to feel basically hated, unwelcomed in the world? And what does it do to your song, your dance, and your playing your instrument? I mean, it's like I'm trying to do my dance and I'm frozen stiff, you see, because I'm too afraid. To dance my dance means to be able to come out here and move and express myself. I don't want to give you the sense of my gestures and maybe my Italianness, if you will, as necessarily dancing my dance as an ideal. What I'm trying to say is that we all have our own ethnic background, our own way of being brought up, and dancing my dance doesn't necessarily mean that you're an excellent dancer. It's dancing your dance for you. But there is a sense that you must say that a person's injured if they're dancing their dance like this. I mean, you see? I mean, there's no grace. And the poor person's very inhibited. And is scared stiff. Now let me just introduce you to the guy who's hugging the wall, you see, and dancing his dance because he's so scared. You know, when you go into a high school and you see those wall huggers, huh? They're frightened. They look a little paranoid. And some of them are nerds, quote unquote, huh? I mean, because they just don't feel like they're part of the world. And that's an awful suffering. And it's a tremendous sexual injury. You see what I mean? Because when you don't feel welcome, you don't belong because you're terrified. I'm talking about terrified. There's other reasons why we don't belong or feel welcome. But if someone scares the hell out of me with a sense of hate or hostility, you see, or you interview people who have been raped or have suffered some form of post-traumatic stress syndrome. I mean, we work with a lot of missionaries at our sabbatical program, and some of these people have been involved with just seeing, especially in Central America, I mean, seeing dead bodies as they come out of their rectory. I mean, that puts you in shock, huh? And it can scare the hell out of you. And it can really terrify you, you see. But just as grown men don't eat quiche, grown men are supposed to not feel fear or terror, you see. And so then I have to cover it over. But anyhow, the point is, I'm just trying to say, to scan your own life and to see if this is where you've been injured. Not so much just coming out of your mother's womb, because you probably don't remember it. But the point is, have you been a recipient of hate and hostility at the beginning of your life or any time during your life, and what kind of impact did that hate and hostility have upon you? Now, some of you may be homosexual in this crowd, and there's certainly a lot of homosexual men in our culture, and have experienced tremendous hate and tremendous hostility. And it may not be personal. It may be through headlines. It may be through stories. I'm just trying to point out, because the topic came up yesterday, you know, in terms of it's very difficult to do their dance and sing their song and play their instrument when, if they make a move, someone's going to kill them or bash them or beat them up. And you may say, oh, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. You get on the elevator and someone starts telling a homosexual joke or a gay joke, you see? And it's very hurtful. And you end up feeling as a gay person that you're in a very hostile space. I mean, it's hostile, you see? Just like the blacks in our culture know what hostility is like, what people and stories turning on them, huh? And in our own ethnic tradition, you know, I remember my father, who was Italian, is Italian, ends up talking about walking on the railroad tracks, going to the Irish grammar school, and really fearing for his life that these Irish kids were going to beat him up. You see? So it's not like just, this whole notion of fearing for your life to a certain degree may have been part of some of our lives. And there's a big difference between fear and terror. You see, terror, you end up fearing for your life. You end up experiencing, I may be annihilated here. Now, I haven't had annihilation experiences in my life personally, but a lot of people have. They have been threatened, in which what's at stake is a sense of annihilation. Okay, let me just move on. Assuming that you've been welcomed, that's a foundational dimension of dancing a dance, singing a song, and playing an instrument. Now, the next stage I would just describe as, and the mother and the father need to fill the baby up, if you will, needs to nourish, support, provide safety, and security for the baby, okay? For the baby, for the infant, for the young child. So you end up, now just giving you some imagery, I end up going into the bank several years ago, and I see this very young-looking girl, if you will. She probably was maybe 17, or she must be 16, 19. But she had two children, and I have a sense that they were her two children. And they were real ragamuffins, if you will. I mean, the kids looked emaciated, unattended to. And then, you know, it made perfect sense. I saw this woman, and she's either taking money out or putting money in the bank, and she's just got enough energy almost like to take care of herself, never mind taking care of these two babies. You see what I mean? So you just look at her, and she's already collapsed at 19. You know, she looks like she's been through two wars, if you will. And maybe she was psychologically. But the point is how much energy, remember I talked about the breath, the breathing of the breath into the boy, how much energy did my mother have, did my father have to breathe into me, so that I end up becoming full, psychically full, feeling security, feeling warmth, feeling supported, feeling nourished, feeling nurtured. And a lot of this is where I think a lot more people can begin to identify that they may have felt welcomed into the world, but were they taken care of the way that I'm describing it? Do you have memories or experiences, or do you feel in your body that you're full? You have been full for a long time. I don't mean full of food, but full of psychic strength, psychic energy that flowed from the significant figures in your life. And a lot of people don't feel that. And so coming back to the imagery of sexuality, dancing your dance, playing your instrument, singing your song, when you're not full, it's just like a little kid blowing into a balloon and doesn't have really strong lung capacity. And they go, and they don't get any place, right? And then you give the balloon to someone who has really big lungs or strong lungs, and they just go, Or if you're seeing at birthday parties, there may be, just say 40 candles on the birthday cake, and the guy has been smoking 3 packs a day, and he's almost on the verge of emphysema, And he ends up saying, everybody saying, okay, now blow out your candles. And the guy goes, and he doesn't have any breath, you see? The poor guy, it's funny, but the poor guy's going to be dying soon, seriously. You know, this is a very serious thing, this emphysema. But it's a good image, you see? Because there are a lot of people who were brought up by emphysema-type mothers and fathers, you see? I mean, they didn't have the disease. But that was the quality of their breath. That's all they had. That's all they were given by their mothers and fathers. See, Pat is 100% right when she talks about what we need to see is this whole story in light of generational things. And, you know, there's a lot of critique of parent bashing and all that business. And I think a lot of people have gone overboard or through their own anger of working their things out end up giving it to the parents, right? But at least that's not my perspective or stand. But I do want to acknowledge that there's been a story. And we've all gone through a story. And it's not my business to point my finger to my mother and father or to anybody. I am a parent. I have been a parent. I still will be a parent. And it's tough stuff. And I only had two. Pat had 12. I mean, it's tough stuff. Constantly being there, and if you really want to be, quote, a good parent, I mean, it's like really being there and giving up an awful lot and sacrificing. And as I say, theoretically, a therapist can only bring a client as far as they have gone themselves in their own personal development. And by the way, you know, I want to use that imagery for pastors and priests. You know, Bishop Wills talking about teaching and leading your people. Well, you only can take your people as far as you've gone personally. That's why ongoing formation is so important. That's why it's so important to continue to do your work. That is to say, to grow, to become the fullest plant possible, so that the bees and the birds would come over and want to drink of your richness. You see? I mean, that's what's so beautiful about the garden. I mean, I have bee balm. The bee balm is just coming out. And it has a terrific fragrance, but it collects bees. Huh? And it's wonderful to see them. And they just swarm in there and just are nourished by the bee balm. And he's using the imagery of a shepherd that plants. Huh? And I'm just trying to say that ongoing formation for me in priesthood means to continue to grow as a human person and as a spiritual person. And Pope Paul VI, encyclical on evangelization, page 36, it says that, you know, the evangelizer, is a witness. And he's calling for an ongoing conversion of the heart. All right, that's just an advertisement, ongoing formation. but coming back, in a sense the second stage, if you will, the second thing that we have to negotiate is how much have we been filled by our parents, by the significant others. The third stage, thing that needs to be negotiated is again, now I'm welcomed and assuming I've been given support, nourishment, safety, nourishment, and security. And there's a whole continuum of that that you have to figure out in your own privacy of your car in your room in a couple weeks. Huh? There's a whole continuum of how much you were given, not just when you were one or two, but through maybe the first 18 years of your life. Okay. Then the next stage is the movement from separating, if you will, individuating yourself from the parents, from these significant others. And that's scary, huh? You can see a little boy, you know, hugging his mom's lap or leg or thigh, you know, kind of wrapped around there. A little girl wrapped around the mother. And it's a frightening world out there. You know, if you were a 3-year-old, assuming that you could walk, and we put you right outside the university on the sidewalk, or even brought you down a mile further into where all the stores are and say goodbye to you and find your way back, I mean, you'd panic. You see what I mean? You'd panic. And so it's difficult to kind of leave the safe environment and move forward and come back. Now the question is, what if my mother or my father ends up saying, okay, son, this is 3 years old, you got to do it on your own now, and ends up just kind of dropping you there, and you kind of run to her, and she's got her back toward you, and she's, I'm too busy, I got to clean the dishes, I got to do this, I got to do this. You know, I gave you enough. Well, you kind of get moving. But it's like too premature. There isn't a sensitivity of what's required. That maybe that's what happened to that mother or that father. That they were just kind of, they were welcomed into the world and they were given a lot of supplies, if you were, for the journey, but then that was it. They said, okay now, and they put you outside and say you're on your own. And being on your own at three, it just doesn't make it, you see. But as I said yesterday, how a lot of us have compensated for that is that we just kind of pull ourselves up and say, okay, I got the message, I'll do it. And somehow, and this becomes crucial, through the use of will, I begin to do it. I begin to respond in my own small way through the use of will. Now remember that guy, let me see, what's his name? He went to jail, G. Gordon Liddy. He wrote a book, huh? I didn't read the book, but someone told me about it. And he's taking pride in being steel, you see? Taking pride. And there's a whole subculture among boys and men, and maybe even a subculture among priests, that we take pride in the use of our will, self-sufficiency, willpower, willfulness, I will do it, and the whole emphasis on the I and the ego, you see? And a lot of times that stuff comes out of not really being supported in this transition. And the boy ends up just kind of pulling together and saying, well, I'm not going to cry over spilt milk. I got to make the best of the situation. And the only thing he has is his will. And he latches onto it, and he ends up becoming a terrifically willful person. And as a result, maybe accomplishes a hell of a lot in his life. But he has steeled himself, you see. In order to do this, you begin to cut yourself off from your heart. See, because your heart as a child, see, I got kicked out of the house. I'm in my backyard or my front yard. I got my knapsack on my back, and someone's giving me a map and saying, go ahead, kid, grow up. You're on your own. And so, but I'm shaking in my boots. I really do feel powerless and helpless. You see, that's kind of the natural reaction. I feel powerless and helpless. But when you steel yourself, that's the whole point of it. You cover over your powerless and helplessness, you see? And you end up saying, I will do it, okay? So this gets a little closer to the average American male. I mean, a lot of people haven't suffered the hostility and the hatred intensified through the needle in their arm of mainline hate and hostility. I would say a lot of people have experienced, a lot of men have experienced a sense of not being given enough at the beginning. But I think a lot more men have responded to that, not being given enough, and also not being supported in the separation individuation phase by the use of the will. Okay? And it's very manly, quote, culturally. You see, remember I said biology, culture, and the individual or the personal story. There's a biological story, there's a cultural story, and a personal story that makes up our sexual story. And certainly the culture ends up valuing, honoring, putting people up there on the wall, lighting incense to willful people who have been very successful citizens. But you see, the kingdom isn't about success. You see, the kingdom is about love. At least the way, that's the story that I got, you see. It's about giving your heart over to God, to Christ. It's about tenderness. It's about compassion. It's about being real as a human being. It's about being humble. A willful person isn't a humble person. You know, they know it. They got all the answers. They got it all mapped out. They're sure. They're sure of everything. And I just want to say, you know, that's been a part of a thread in my own life, because the values of being a boy and being a man have been kneaded into my bones. I'm part of being influenced by the media, and so one of my tasks is to at least try to uncover that, and then by uncovering it and owning it. And trying to work it through as much as I'm able to, I got a better chance. Being who I am. I may not fully arrive, but at least I'm trying. You see, as opposed to a person, you want to say, you want to whisper, you want to yell, you're going to kill yourself, huh? With this willful business, this self-sufficiency business, the business that says, I don't need anybody. You see? So that person is in a compromise. You sing your song, you dance your dance, and you play your instrument, not necessarily by yourself. You do that with others. But if I have had to pull myself up and be the self-sufficient one, I can play the role of the social citizen. I can play the role of social intimacy. But my heart may not be open. I don't allow people to touch my heart. See, because if I allow people to touch my heart as this willful person, I may end up collapsing into the old story of being the little kid with the knapsack on the front of my apartment or the front of our house, and I may end up starting to cry and cry about what happened to this poor kid. So the willful person needs to really hold themselves up, stiffen themselves. And it's like the ultimate is the bodybuilder, huh? They pump themselves up. You see? They're pumped up. They're inflated. You see? They inflate themselves. Pat used the word grandiosity. I mean, these people are pumped up. And I don't mean the Beach Boys. I mean, not the singers. But, the beach men, you know, they kind of, they got their tank top and their chest out and 44 and they're really like pulled up and, you know, just strutting along, you know. But, you know, you just go and you start, their arms are like this. They don't have any flexibility. You see with their arms because it's so pumped up. They can't dance their dance. Do you ever see a weightlifter dance? No, I mean, because they're so tight. You see, pumping up iron tightens you. That's the whole point. It looks good, I guess. But it certainly doesn't feel good. And it certainly doesn't, it's not part of being able to dance. I mean, they can't feel their pelvis. I mean, they're really pulled right up. So they can't sing their song, dance their dance, and play their instrument with a sense of freedom and ease and relaxation and openness and receptivity. They don't really have faith. They have faith in pumping themselves up. You know, if I only can lift 250 pounds, no one's going to mess with me, you see? But see, now if we kind of take that, they're a psychological pumped up priest, you see? They don't have the 42 chest, you know, but they have this 42 head, you see? That moves around and sort of says, I know it all, you see? And they have memorized all the dogma and all this kind of stuff. And they can spout it off, but they're disconnected from their heart. And they're disconnected from their bodies. Huh? And they can't sing their song and dance their dance and play their instrument. Sexuality isn't alive. It's another form of this walking dead zombie sleepwalker that Sam Keen talks about. They don't look burnt out, but they're certainly disconnected. There's a deficiency of passion. The passion that they have is the passion of will. They're up to something. They're always into a project, always conquering, always involved with triumph. Now, I'm exaggerating all this. You understand that. And just to get my point across. But I'm trying to paint a picture of a style. And then there's continuums of that style. And I know what it's like to end up being, because it's, let me just give you a little footnote about my own history here. It's just a good example of the father and son issue. My father's a very good man. I love him very much. And we've had a lot of very good talks. And in many ways, he is like Zorba for me. But he got out of the Navy. He was a seaman in World War II. And he ended up having the GI Bill. And he married my mother right away. And they went off to California. And he went to Caltech. And he was going to be an engineer. And my mother was a homebody. They got pregnant with me. My mother says, and my father comes from a very insecure background. And I'll just give you a little hint of how awful a part of his life was. He was on his mother was on her deathbed. And he hadn't heard her ever say, "I love you." And he was hoping, and I was with him, and he was hoping beyond hope that by the last breath, she would say, "I love you." And that never happened. And that's a tremendous injury. Okay. So this is the man that's my father. Right? And again, I love him. Zorba the Greek in many ways. A real philosopher in many ways. Opened up a lot of things for me. But my point is that he was so insecure. Didn't know this. But he's so insecure. My mother was a homebody. She says, "I can't have the baby here. I have to go back to New England with my mother to have the baby." And I think, because I've talked about it with my dad, I think that he was so insecure that if my mother really left by herself or went back, she would never come back. And so he ended up getting out of school, getting on a train. They went back home. And she had the baby, and my father didn't have a job, and he started pumping gas, and then he became a machinist, and he was just so overwhelmed that now he has a baby, and he didn't have the imagination to go to school and work at the same time. He ended up just kind of collapsing into what I think all the other people around his neighborhood ended up doing. But the point is, he didn't go on for his education, and he ended up, all his dreams, this is like 20 years old or 21, all his dreams end up come crashing in and he makes the best of the situation. But now, what he does, consciously or unconsciously, I think it was unconscious, he's going to put all his money on his son. I'm number one son. Okay? And that's what happened. I mean, that's part of the positive reception of all this energy. But there is a sense, I mean, and they have, I tried to encourage to take them down, but all my brothers and sisters, there's this trophy in our living room. Trophies. All of us have brought home all kinds of trophies. I don't know if that was a conscious choice on our part. It was part of the story. That's what they wanted. They wanted people who produced. And I don't say this in a harshness, but part of my struggle is, my dad's still on my back, you see, pushing me, and he can't wait until I get my book done, you see. You see, I mean, I didn't have an intention of writing a book, but I got my PhD, and with the next breath, he's saying, well, when are you going to write your book, you see? So the point is that he, is living his life, through me in many ways, and I receive the sense of push and being driven. And that's part of my suffering in life, is I'm a driven person. I mean, I can accomplish a lot, I can achieve a lot, but that's part of my own spiritual story, is I use my drivenness as a sacramental. That's why I build my garden. That's why silence and solitude is so important. I have befriended my drivenness as much as I can at this moment, and I'm trying to get it to use, I'm using it as a way of reminding me that as much as I drive myself, I'm really not in control, you see. So I got this little thing called drivenness that I'm trying to help integrate into my life and be my teacher, you see. Okay, last 3 or 4 minutes. Singing my song, dancing my dance, playing my instrument. Another stage, assuming now that I'm supported in my transition to moving out. And I'm doing it with just noticeable differences. I move, I I walk 200 feet away from my house. I come back. I tell my mother and father how scared I am. They talk to me about it. And then I go out and I go a quarter of a mile. And I just keep on going back and forth. And then I can case my neighborhood. And eventually I adjust, okay? But another part of playing my instrument is self-expression. And I think this gets a little, you know, whatever stage you want, whatever age, huh? But at some point, you know, I end up discovering, I don't know this at four, but I'm angry or I'm sad. I start having all kinds of feelings and I start expressing them. And all of a sudden, I'm greeted with, stop it. You see? And all of a sudden, it's like in the cartoons where, at least when I was growing up, they had these cartoons where the one character takes the top of a trash can and goes like this on top of the head and crushes the person, huh? And there's this character that's only about 2 inches. And it's like, how has your emotions been crushed? You see, none of that in this house, please. There will be no crying. There will be no expressing of anger. There will not be even expression of affection. So don't count on it from us, and we're not going to count it on for you. Okay, so now we have a person, assuming that you have some energy, and that you ever see these kids, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed little boys and little girls? I mean, they're just all filled with life. And all of a sudden, at a certain stage, someone says, okay, that was okay then, but none of this anymore. You see? So the expression of emotions isn't fostered. And so how can you sing your song? The fellow, you know, who sang today, they had a beautiful voice, you know, at Mass. I was just thinking of it. It's just the guy singing his song, if you will, huh? Leading us in song. But you can't really express the song, your dance, playing the instrument if you feel inhibited, if you feel constricted, if you feel like you're not supposed to, you can't. So there's a lot of people who suffer at night grinding their teeth, huh? And they go to the dentist and the dentist says, you know, what's wrong with you, man? You're grinding your teeth down. I'm going to have to put new teeth in. I mean, they're so angry. During the night, they have to wear an appliance, huh? Because they grind their teeth, and they're going to grind them down. I mean, so there may be a history of this person cannot express appropriately his feelings, in particular anger, or sexuality, or love. So in the priesthood, it becomes very important, you know, to be able to do this. Because it's like being B-bomb, that you want the people to come. And it's interesting. He says, feed my flock. Huh? My bee bomb are feeding the bees. Huh? And, you know, without getting the image to limp, but you get the point of how can you become the best flower you can be and to let people, in a good sense, not codependent sense, feed from you. Because you have good soil, good energy streaming from you that's always being replaced because you're taking care of your garden, you're taking care of yourself, you're renewing yourself so that you can keep on not giving in the sense of effort giving. It just flows naturally. I mean, there's a side in which people say, a couple of people asked us this morning, you know, being therapist, I mean, isn't that, don't you get drained and all that? I mean, for me, my job is not a job. It's a way of life. I get paid to live my life. I mean, that's how I feel. Yes, I get tired. I'm tired at night. But I mean, it's just sort of like I feel so, privileged to walk with people and people's stories touch my heart as they touch your heart. And I feel not weighted down. I would feel weighted down if I felt it was all up to me. But see, my God says, my will be done, meaning God's will. That's why that ultimate meaning is so important. I mean, I get nervous. I get anxious. I end up getting trapped by, I have to really help this person. But, you know, I begin to pray to myself. and just try to become, you know, in St. Francis' word, an instrument of his peace, not my peace. You see? So I just find all this Christian business so helpful for my life as a therapist and as a professional. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, in terms of the shepherds, see, the priest, who come not just as patients or clients of mine. I say, well, haven't you heard about the good news? Really? Really? In terms of taking it in from your heart. Really? Because I look around, and a lot of times among thousands of clergy, I really don't see joyous men. And I could tell you all the reasons why I think. But I think, you know, the bees go to a live bee bomb, if you will. You see? Okay. The last, and then we'll take a break. Expressing. So in order to be able to sing my song, dance my dance, play my instrument, I need to be able to express. And this comes the hardest one. And you may get it, you may not, and maybe you'll read about it as I write about it. Not for my father. But my point here is there's a certain stage in which the focus is on our heart. We have a heart. And I end up, as an example, if you went to kindergarten on the first grade, at least where I went, on Mother's Day, Thanksgiving, Christmas, all those times, you'd end up writing a letter or doing a present to your mother or your father. Huh? And can you imagine that? You're a 5-year-old. You come in with all kinds of excitement. I'm talking about excitement. I mean, you've labored over this card because you love your mother so much. You love your father so much, huh? And you really have put all yourself into this. And you come up and you're in the kitchen and you end up saying, Happy Thanksgiving. You see, and it took a lot just to kind of put it out there because you don't know, you think it's not that perfect and all that. And all of a sudden she takes it and says, oh, what's this? You see? Well, I mean, if we had a video to capture this little boy's face, you see? I mean, crushed, but I'm talking about the heart, crushed, brokenhearted. Or I end up bruising my knee, and I'm limping, and I go to my mother or my father, and I cry, and she says, come on, you're a big boy, stop this. You see? See, I wasn't just giving her my leg, I was giving her my heart. You see? And the question is, as you assuming you were at some point in your life that your heart was still vibrantly pulsating with love towards your mother, towards your father, towards all those who took care of you, how did they take up your heart when you really started... can you just hold this for a minute? When you just started opening your heart like this, you see? Thank you. You did very good. You know, where you're just walking around, and you see this among little kids. They're just walking. They have their heart on their sleeves. They're just walking around. You'll love me. Receive my love in their own little way. And the question is, how did the significant others in your life respond to that? Okay. So, if they ended up, you know, kind of not receiving your gift, whatever your gift is, you're interested in frogs, your world that's flowing out of your world, and they can't bend down. Did you ever notice when you bend down with little kids and meet them face to face, how much more they respond to you? Bending down, huh? And offering your heart and being met by someone else's heart, it certainly helps you to sing your song, you see, and dance your dance and play your instrument. So the point is, where has your heart been, you see? And it's very fascinating about Jeremiah and the circumcision of the heart and the ongoing conversion of the heart. This is part of what I think that story is about, going back and seeing what the heck happened to your heart along the way. What condition psychically is your heart? Because the Lord is saying to be a follower of His is to be a follower with a full heart, a whole heart, you see? A vibrant heart. And I'm asking you, in your car 2 weeks from now, in your own rooms, back at wherever you live, to investigate what is the story of your heart as part of your own sexual story of being a boy and becoming a man. Thank you very much.